Chapter 4. The Lie. I'm better than you. I feel the need to confess. I shave my toes. I totally do. Sometimes, not all the time, mind you, I look down in the shower and see my big toes sprouting locks long enough to braid. It's embarrassing, sure. But a quick swipe of my razor returns my toe knuckles to their usual silky smooth glory. None of this would be such an epic admission for me to make, except that I once made fun of a girl in freshman year English class for doing this exact thing. Blarg! I feel like such a jerk even now, 150 years later. Friends, let me paint a quick picture of myself in high school. I was a solid 20 pounds heavier. I wore clothes from the Goodwill, and I was the president of the drama club. I wasn't someone who teased others. I was someone who got teased. But there was that one instance when I did tease. The one and only time in my memory that I actively made fun of someone else. Maybe that's why it sticks out in my brain. Maybe that's why it still feels so shameful. We'll call this girl Shmina. Her actual name is Tina, but I'm trying to write in code here. Shmina was the girl who always seemed totally confident in herself. She developed breasts and a sense of humor light years before the rest of us, and she was popular in a way I would never be. One day, in Mrs. Giacchetti's English class, when we were supposed to be writing a paper on Zora Neale Hurston, Shmina mentioned something about shaving her toes. I don't know why she mentioned it. I assume popular girls share grooming tidbits the way the rest of us mortals talk about the weather. But anyway, while I didn't say anything to her directly, I talked so much smack about it to my best friend later that day. Who shaves their feet? More importantly, who has hairy digits in need of shaving? Shmina clearly has some kind of glandular disease she's not copping to. What a ridiculous conversation. Most people would have forgotten about a conversation like that by now, but it keeps haunting me years later because the whole time I was mocking Shmina and her hairy toes, I was totally shaving my own! To this day, hand to God, whenever I look down at my big toe and see that it's looking a little shaggy, I think about what a jerk my teenage self was. Rage flaw number one, hairy digits. Rage flaw number two, hypocrisy. A story about hairy toes, a girl named Shmina, and the adolescent angst I should have really worked through with a licensed therapist years ago may seem like the most frivolous topic ever. But then, I dare say that tearing down other women is usually based on something no less frivolous than the insecurities of our 14-year-old selves. Why do we do it, ladies? Why do we gossip? Why do we rag on each other? Why do we say hello on Sunday mornings with the same tongues we used to lash others behind their backs a few days later? Does it make us feel better about ourselves? Does it make us feel safer to mock someone who has stepped outside the parameters we deem acceptable? If we can point out their flaws, does doing so diminish our own? Of course it doesn't. In fact, the stones we most often try and fling at others are the ones that have been thrown at us. Have you ever shaved your toes? And what I really mean by that is, have you ever made fun of someone else? Have you ever pointed your finger in their direction and ignored the three other fingers on your hand pointing back at you? We've all been there, but that doesn't make it okay. Bringing others down won't elevate you. Recognizing that all words have power, even the ones whispered behind someone's back, is how you adjust your behavior. A few weeks ago, there was a woman on my plane from LA to Chicago. She and her husband were traveling with two boys, the youngest of whom was about four. He was also the worst behaved child I've ever seen. Before we'd even pulled back from the gate, he was screaming. And I don't mean a whine or a protest. I mean screaming bloody murder about having to sit in a seat when he wanted to run around. His mother had to forcibly hold him in the chair for at least half an hour while he hollered to be released. Everyone on the plane, myself included, was miserable until he stopped. But a little while later, when I got up to go to the restroom, I saw why he'd finally quieted. He'd been given a big bag of gummy worms to happily eat his way through. Friends, I will be honest with you. I was disgusted. First of all, as a strict parent who was raised by strict parents, listening to him scream, I thought, oh, heck no. All through takeoff, I was thinking about his mom. I was thinking about how she needed to discipline him better, have boundaries, get support from her spouse. And when I saw that she'd rewarded his bad behavior, and with sugar, keep me near the cross, Lord Jesus, I kept thinking, this woman doesn't have a clue. Later, at baggage claim, I saw the family again. The four-year-old was wild, jumping up on the stopped luggage belt, hitting his brother, and running around in circles while everyone stared. What is wrong with his mother? I kept thinking. Why doesn't she get a handle on him? Then I saw her standing next to the luggage carousel, utterly exhausted. When I really looked at her, I saw she was near tears, looking bewildered and totally overwhelmed. Her husband wore the same shell-shocked expression as their son ran in circles around them. And a gentle voice reminded me, Rachel, you don't know their story. I was so humbled in my ignorance. Maybe this little boy had special needs that made it hard for him to control his impulses. Maybe this little boy was a new adoptive child who had struggled in foster homes for most of his young life, something I should be grateful about given what we've been through. Maybe this little boy was just badly behaved and his parents were struggling to discipline him because their older son had been so easy to manage at this age. Whatever the reason, I will never know, because instead of asking or offering the benefit of the doubt, I cast my judgment on her before I even ask myself why things might be this way. Women judging other women. It's been on my heart for a while. It's something I've tried to wrap my brain around fully so I could put it into words. I see it all around me in so many different ways, and that poor, tired mama on the flight to Chicago reminded me of what I want to say. What I want to say is that we all judge each other. But even though we all do it, that's not an excuse. Judging is still one of the most hurtful, spiteful impulses we own, and our judgments keep us from building a stronger tribe, or from having a tribe in the first place. Our judgment prohibits us from beautiful, life-affirming friendship. Our judgment keeps us from connecting in deeper, richer ways because we're too stuck on the surface-level assumptions we've made. Ladies, our judging has to stop. So does our compulsion to compete with everyone around us. Let me give an example of that, too. When I heard that some of my girlfriends were going to run the Nike Women's Half Marathon in San Francisco, I was excited. For some of them, it was their first race. I was also overjoyed because it would involve a weekend trip somewhere. I promptly invited myself along for the ride. The plan was for us to leave on Friday, drive the 5-ish hours between LA and SF, hang out in town on Saturday, then run the race and drive home on Sunday. Wait, scratch that. They would run the race. I would stand on the side of the road and clap for them while they jogged by. This felt especially interesting because I am a runner. And more than that, I am competitive about running. I like to challenge myself. I like to try bigger and better races. I like to beat my personal record and push myself to be the best. What I do not like, what I had never actually done, is cheering for others while they do something I am fully capable of doing right along with them. I kept thinking, what if I didn't need to prove myself in this situation? What if making myself into someone better has more to do with my willingness to be of service than my willingness to compete? So I went to San Francisco. In fact, I drove everyone to San Francisco because I figured the last thing I'd want if I were about to run 13 miles would be to drive 400 miles. It's worth saying that while I did all of this and had so much stinking fun with the ladies, I didn't always have a good attitude about my willingness to be a cheerleader. On Sunday morning, when everyone headed out bright and early to the starting line, I got myself together and headed in the other direction, to the 5-mile marker. About 20 minutes into my journey, I realized it was unlikely that I would get a cab at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning. Around this time, I realized that walking alone in the dark in downtown SF might be one of the dumbest things I've ever done. I legitimately thought at one point, see, this is what happens when you try and do something nice. You get murdered on the streets of an unknown city. I get pretty dramatic when I'm in fear for my life and haven't had any coffee. Anyway, at that point, I decided to turn around and head for the finish line since walking there felt safer than walking to mile 5. Turns out, walking to the finish line meant walking up approximately 32 hills that were taller than some mountains I know. I was sweaty and grouchy by the time I arrived, grumbling under my breath about the whole ordeal and thinking, why on earth did I agree to do this? Then I saw my first elite marathon runner. Elite marathon runners are those superhumans who run a race in like 5 minutes. They look like cheetahs or gazelles as they fly down the road, and they are truly breathtaking to behold. As someone who ran 12.5-minute miles in my first marathon, elite female runners, by comparison, run like 6 or 7-minute miles. I was in awe. Since I'm always so far behind these athletes in the race, I've never been able to see one. I stood there and watched one after another sprint by and felt so blessed to see them in action. For the 2.5 hours that followed, I stood in that exact spot and cheered on strangers. I clapped nonstop, my skill as a preacher's daughter finally coming into play. I screamed until my throat was sore. I yelled all the things that encourage me when I hear them from the sidelines during a race. You are so strong. You're almost there. You can do this. And the last one is something I've never heard but always tell myself when it gets hard during a run. I yelled it over and over again whenever I saw someone who looked ready to drop. You've lived through tougher things than this. Don't give up now. Finally, it was there, in that exact spot, that I got to see my friends Katie and Brittany jogging up from mile 12 in their first ever half marathon. You can see it in a picture someone shot of us. I'm screaming like a maniac and trying not to throw myself over the fence to attack them with hugs. I was so proud of them, I was laughing and crying as if their achievement was somehow my own. I jogged alongside them, outside the track, wrapped up in the joy of the moment, and I heard God very distinctly say, "Imagine all of the things you would have missed today if you'd only been out here for yourself." I never would have seen the elite runners. I never would have been there when my friend Hannah ran her personal best, 13.1 miles in under 2 hours. I wouldn't have been able to stand next to Joy, who put my cheering to shame. After running her own race, she screamed louder than anyone from the sidelines, encouraging the other runners. I wouldn't have been there to hug Katie and Brittany. I wouldn't have seen any of it. I would have run another half marathon, like I'd done 10 times before, and I'd have nothing to show for it but a little extra pride and the banana they give you at the end. The first step toward getting past the desire to judge and compete is admitting that nobody is immune. For some of us, we judge in little ways, rolling our eyes at the way someone is dressed, frowning at the badly behaved child in the grocery store, or making assumptions about another mother at school pickup who has a serious expression and wears a suit every day and seems uptight. For others, judging is a bigger problem. berating your little sister because her views are different from yours, viciously gossiping with other women, taking to social media to write hateful things to people you don't even know simply because they've stepped outside the lines of what you think is good. The second step is recognizing that just because you believe it doesn't mean it's true for everyone. In so many instances, judgment comes from a place of feeling as though you've somehow got it all figured out when they do not. Judging each other actually makes us feel safer in our own choices. Faith is one of the most abused instances of this. We decide that our religion is right. Therefore, every other religion must be wrong. Within the same religion, or heck, even within the same church, people judge each other for not being the right kind of Christian, Catholic, Mormon, or Jedi. I don't know the central tenet of your faith, but the central tenet of mine is love thy neighbor. Not love thy neighbor if they look and act and think like you. Not love thy neighbor so long as they wear the right clothes and say the right things. Just love them. Yes, I also believe in holding each other accountable. But holding each other accountable takes place inside community and relationships. Holding each other accountable comes from a beautiful place in the heart of friendship that makes you sit down with your friend and ask with love if they've ever looked at their own actions in a particular light. Holding each other accountable comes from a place of love. Judgment comes from a place of fear, disdain, or even hate. So be careful about dressing up your judgments as accountability to make your conscience feel better. I have worked tirelessly over the last couple of years to create content that caters to women. I have spent numerous hours trying to figure out exactly what women like us want in life. Do you know what they want? Do you know the number one thing that I hear most, get emails about most, get asked for advice on most? Friends. How to make friends. How to keep friends. How to cultivate real, valuable relationships. That's what women are craving. That's what they really want and hope for. And if that's true, we have to start at the beginning. We start from the beginning and we teach ourselves to keep an open mind. We begin with that first hello or handshake and we stop ourselves from making decisions not founded in fact and experience. We look for commonality instead of seeking out differences. We ignore things like hair or clothes or weight or race or religion or socioeconomic background. We pay attention to things like character and heart and wisdom and experience. And no, it might not be easy, but I promise you, it will be worth it. Your tribe is out there. And if you haven't found it yet, I challenge you to consider that maybe your people come in a different package than you thought they might. Things that helped me. Number one, non-judgmental friends. We often become whoever we surround ourselves with. If your friends are full of gossip and vitriol, I promise you'll start to develop the habit. When you're looking for a community of women, look for the ones who want to build each other up instead of tear each other down. Number two, policing myself. If we're already judgmental, and let's be honest, most of us are, we have to work hard on policing ourselves. When I find myself judging someone in my head, I force myself to stop and think of compliments about that person. By doing this, I'm learning to look for the positive instead of reaching for the negatives. Number three, dealing with it. Usually our judgment and gossip come from a deep well of our own insecurities. Get to the bottom of what's going on with you. What's making you lash out at others? The first step toward becoming the best version of yourself is being honest, truly honest, about what makes you tick. Chapter 5. The Lie. Loving him is enough for me. I fell in love the first time I saw him. Does that sound dramatic? Probably. I'm not even sure I was aware of it at the time, but the scene plays out so clearly in my memory. I went out to the lobby to get my boss's 11 o'clock appointment. There was only one man standing there. His back was to me, hands down deep in his pockets. He had a beat-up leather messenger bag slung over his shoulder. I noticed the bag first. I remember thinking it was so cool that this guy wore business clothes but carried a worn-in leather bag instead of a briefcase. "Excuse me," I said as I crossed the lobby. "Are you here to meet with Kevin?" In my mind, he turns around in slow motion. The memory illuminates when I first see his face. He smiles at me and reaches out a hand to shake mine. The moment stretches into infinity, then snaps back together like elastic. It speeds back up into real time. Something just happened, I distinctly remember thinking. I was equal parts excited and terrified. He was older and totally out of my league. Still, I caught myself thinking, but maybe. That maybe is what did it. My curiosity wouldn't go away. It was enough to startle me, to make me wish I was wearing something cuter than a black maxi skirt and an ill-fitting matching t-shirt. That day wasn't the first time I'd spoken to him. He called to talk to my boss often. It was the first time I'd spoken to him in person. I'd had no idea what he looked like, or more specifically, that he was so handsome. And what had been a business relationship quickly turned into something more flirtatious. It's important to note here that I had zero experience with men. I'd been hired as an intern during my first year of college. That summer, they offered me a job, and I promptly dropped out of school to accept it. I had just turned 19 years old. At this ripe old age, I had smooched a couple of boys in high school, but I'd never had a real relationship and had never been on a date. I might have been professionally mature beyond my years, but when it came to romance, I had the life experience of an amoeba. Our relationship progressed over email and staring at each other during business functions. It's probably also fair to tell you that I had my big sister's ID. So at those business functions, I ordered a glass of wine like everyone else. Given the job I had, this man never thought to question my age. I also never willingly volunteered the information. It's also worth telling you that he was 8 years and a lifetime of experience ahead of me. He asked me out on my first real date, and I spent days trying to figure out what to wear. I was a little surprised to find him dressed so casually when I arrived. It was telling in retrospect, his preparation for this date versus mine, but I can only see that in hindsight. We walked down the street to a little Italian restaurant. I tried to keep it cool, though internally freaking out that we were on a date. I was so nervous. I worried that he would try to hold my hand or kiss me or both. I had no idea how to handle either situation with grace, and I prayed fervently that I wouldn't be put into a position to figure it out. We were seated at a table. We ordered a bottle of wine. "I hope you're not one of those girls who's afraid to eat on a date," he laughed. It annoyed me. Whoever or whatever kind of girl I was hadn't been determined yet. I didn't like the comparison to anyone else. Didn't like the reminder that this wasn't his very first date, too. I responded by eating more than half the pizza we were sharing. He talked about himself for 2 hours straight. I didn't mind. I was fascinated. That night, when he walked me to my car, I thought I might be sick. I was 99% sure he would try to kiss me, and I felt confident that I wasn't a girl who kissed on the first date. I mean, I had no practice with this theory, but it felt like the truth. So when I went to throw my bag into the front seat and turned around to see him leaning in, I immediately threw both hands up in between us, real graceful-like, and yelled, "Don't kiss me!" He paused, a deer in headlights, before chuckling like some sexy leading man. "I was going to give you a hug," he told me. He reached for my hand and gave it a firm shake, but just to be safe. It was so charming, I wanted to die. My mortification knew no bounds. I drove away from that date bemused and a little bit in love. I was positive, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I would marry that man. After one meal of pizza and cheap red wine, we were officially dating. Or at least, I thought we were. I didn't know there were rules. I didn't know there was even a game. Soon, after that first date, he asked me out on another. This time for soup at an ultra-hip restaurant that was popular at the time. Only in LA can you unironically invite someone on a date to a trendy local soup joint and nobody finds it odd. A week later, he asked me when I graduated college, because dude, I still hadn't told him my age. On some level, I knew he wasn't going to be happy about our age difference. The email I wrote him back, because this was before text messaging kids, started with, "Well, this should be interesting." He responded like a champ. He told me I was Doogie Howser, and I did feel like some sort of child prodigy, because not only did I have this job, but I was also in a real relationship with a grown-up. I didn't know it at the time, but on the other side of that email, that grown-up was very unhappy. It came up on our next date. I was too young, I was too inexperienced in every way, and he didn't want to be the guy that hurt me. Can you believe me when I tell you that I didn't hear him at all? I mean, my ears were working just fine, but my brain couldn't even process the idea. I kept thinking, how in the world could you possibly hurt me? We're going to get married and have babies. It's going to be awesome. I mean, bless my tiny, ignorant heart. He resisted, but I was dogged in my pursuit. I thought I was mature enough to handle it. I went quickly from never having gone on a date to spending every night at his apartment. For clarity's sake, let me spell it out. At that point, we weren't having sex. But honestly, that was a technicality. Are you supposed to admit all of this when you write a book for a Christian publisher? I have no idea. But I know for a fact that I am not the only good Christian girl who fell in love with a man and threw every ideal she'd ever believed right out the window because nothing mattered to her more than being loved by him. A month into our relationship, we went to a party at my friend's house. And because I was a tiny baby bunny, I introduced everyone to my boyfriend that night. "This is my boyfriend. Have you met my boyfriend? Who's he? Oh, that's just my boyfriend." Ugh, I cringe at the memory. I also cringe remembering the next day, when he was clearly upset with me but wouldn't tell me why. I kept asking until he finally gave a frustrated huff. "You've never acted your age before, but last night, it was like it was written on your shirt." Ouch. On the one hand, in a lot of ways, he was right. I had always been incredibly professional at work and mature when we hung out. But in this instance, I didn't know the rules. I didn't understand that you couldn't just call a guy your boyfriend without a discussion. I naively believed that if someone had seen your boobs and you regularly went to dinner together, it meant you were a couple. Just to put a little more truth on this, I had zero guilt about the whole "here are my boobs" thing because I believed we were getting married. I justified my choices because I thought they were part of the bigger story of us. Meanwhile, this man didn't even believe we were dating. 34-year-old Rachel can see all of this so clearly in hindsight. 19-year-old me was in love and insecure, so I justified everything he said or did that was hurtful. It's hard for me to write all of this down. It will be hard for my husband to read it. Dave is so different from that man, and it will be tough for him to learn, in detail I've never fully shared, how much this treatment hurt me. But here's the deal. I am not the only woman who ever let a man treat her badly. It's important to tell my story because I believe some of you may find yourself in a similar situation now. And I hope you get out of the trees long enough to see the forest. In telling my story and my truth, I hope it can help some of you make better choices than I did, or see your reality for what it actually is. Because here's the ugly truth. I was a booty call. The preacher's daughter, the one who hadn't ever been on a date, the conservative good girl, I drove to this man's house every single night he asked me to, and pretended that it didn't gut me when he wouldn't acknowledge me during the day. When we were together, he was so sweet and so loving that it held me over during the times when he wouldn't call. On the rare occasions when I'd meet up with him at a bar and his friends would ignore me, or worse, refer to me only as the 19-year-old, and he wouldn't say anything to stop them, I made excuses. I was like the overweight girl at school who makes fun of herself before anyone else can. I acted as though I was in on the joke, that I was a joke, that I wasn't worth defending. When he would flirt with other girls in front of me, or invite me somewhere just to ignore me all night, I told myself to play it cool. He'd reacted so badly when I called him my boyfriend, and I'd learned enough to know that if I brought up any of this, I'd be seen as clingy. I took whatever scraps he gave me, and worse still, I was thrilled to receive them. As I write these words, I'm crying. I didn't cry when I wrote the chapter about my brother's death or the pain of my childhood, but this flays me. I am so sad for that little girl who didn't know better. I am devastated that nobody prepared her for life or taught her to love herself so she wasn't so desperate to get any form of it from someone else. I'm sad that she had to figure it out on her own. I'm disappointed that it took her so long. It took me a year. A whole year of whatever you want, whatever you need, whatever you think is best. A year during which I tried everything I could think of, tried to be everything he wanted, attentive but not clingy, pretty without trying too hard, funny and smart and cool, nice to his friends even when they treated me like garbage, caring and thoughtful when he wanted me around and never bothering him if he didn't call me first. Toward the end of that year, when his company moved him to another state and our already tenuous relationship was threatened, my virginity went from technical to non-existent. It was the last best way I could think of to hold on to him. It didn't work. 2 months after he moved away, he flew home long enough to break up with me. He wanted a clean break, he said. He needed a chance to really put down roots in his new city, he said. He cared about me, he said. It just wasn't going to work out, he said. We'd always be friends, he said. I can see it perfectly in my mind, though I don't often remember that day in real detail because it was so heartbreaking for me. My bed had a bright pink and orange IKEA comforter, and as I sat in the middle of it, I wept. The memory makes me lower my head, and it brings my heart to its knees. You may read this chapter and feel anger at the way that man treated me, or anger at the position I'd put myself in, but I didn't see any of it. I had no pride. I sat in the middle of that neon duvet, and instead of standing up for myself, I begged him not to leave me. He left anyway. I cried myself to sleep that night. The next morning, I got into my car and drove to my hometown 2 hours away to spend Thanksgiving with my family. That day was miserable. Use your imagination to dream up the kind of conversations I was forced into by well-meaning Southern aunts when I'd been dumped. Jesus wept. When I got back in my car to drive home that night, I saw that I had a voicemail. Somehow, I knew he'd call me that day. It was routine, after all. He would do something hurtful, then I would accept it and wait by the phone to see if he wanted another go. I held off listening to that call for the 2 hours it took me to get back to my apartment. I dialed the number for my voicemail and stood immobile as I listened to his message. He was just checking in on me, he said. wanted to make sure I was okay. It was a divine moment in my life. Never before or since have I experienced such total clarity. I stood in my crappy Hollywood apartment and saw our relationship like a map before me. There was the spot where we first kissed. The detour when we didn't talk for 2 weeks after I called him my boyfriend. The night he flirted with the popular girls from work in front of me. Then there was the day I first heard the line, "We're not together, but we're not not together." I saw that phrase and platitudes like it scattered like mortar shells over the terrain. There was the first time he called and asked me to come over after getting drunk at a bar I wasn't invited to. For a year, I'd only looked at the pretty parts of our relationship, and for the first time, I made myself see what was really there. "Who are you?" I asked my empty bedroom. But that was the wrong question to ask. The issue wasn't that I didn't know who I was. The problem was that I didn't know who I had allowed myself to become. It might surprise you to know that I don't blame him for anything that happened that year. Though he was a grown man, he had his own baggage. He was young and immature in his own way. People will treat you with as much or as little respect as you allow them to. And our dysfunctional relationship started the first time he treated me badly, and I accepted it. I called him back, just as I had 100 times before, but this time I was totally calm. I had no anxiety about what he might think, and I wasn't excited to talk to him. When he answered the phone, he immediately launched into questions about how I was feeling and if I'd had fun with my family, as if we were old friends catching up, as if he hadn't eviscerated me the day before. "Hey," I interrupted him. He went silent. I like to believe there was something in my tone that made him pause, but perhaps it was simply startling because I had never interrupted before. Calmly and without any dramatics, I told him, "I am done with this. I am done with you. Don't ever call me again." It wasn't a bid for attention or an attempt at playing hard to get. I meant every single word. "Why?" he choked out. "Because I don't deserve to be treated like this. Because I can't go back and forth. Because I don't like what I've become, but mostly because you said we were friends. This whole time, whatever else has happened, you told me I was your friend. I don't want to be friends if this is how you treat someone you care about." I meant those words with every fiber of my being. I hung up on him and shut off my phone. I brushed my teeth and put on pajamas. Then I went to bed and crawled under that pink blanket and went to sleep dry-eyed and peaceful for the first time in months. I remember that night as the first time I really felt like a grown woman. I woke up to someone banging on my front door. This is the great part of the story. This is the moment that feels like a movie or a romance novel. This is where I tell you that I woke up and found my husband on the other side of my front step. The man who treated me badly, who had strung me along, and who couldn't make up his mind was lost somewhere between his parents' house and my apartment that Thanksgiving night. I know it seems dramatic, but that's really what happened. I remember everything in our relationship as either before or after this moment, our love story being reborn. And it is a love story. Our relationship is the greatest gift in my life. Dave is my best friend, the first real caretaker I ever had, and I have had the honor of watching him grow from that guy into a wonderful husband, father, and friend. But every story is not perfect. Very few roads to love are easy to navigate, and ours was no exception. But it's important to me that you know that while our journey hasn't been easy, the 14 years since that first really crappy one have totally outweighed the mistakes we both made. It's important for me to tell you this story because it is the story of us. My husband is brave and humble to support me in sending it out in the world in hopes that it might serve someone else. It's also important to understand that I don't believe this is typically how it works out. Opening the door that night and finding Dave on the front porch begging me for one more chance feels special because it was special. What is far more likely to happen in most cases is that as long as you allow someone to treat you badly, they will continue to do so. If you're not able to value yourself, no one else will either. I hesitate to even tell you the ending because I don't want anyone to use it as an excuse to stay in an unhealthy relationship in the hopes that it will become healthy. Our story ended well, but that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been willing to walk away. That night in my bedroom, I hit the point where I couldn't live one more day without self-respect. I couldn't stay with a partner who didn't truly value who I was as a person. Sometimes, choosing to walk away, even if it means breaking your own heart, can be the greatest act of self-love you have access to. What else can I tell you? What can I offer you as insight or wisdom or what I hope you receive from this chapter? I hope that if you read yourself in my story, it will hold up a mirror for you. I hope you'll get out of the trees long enough to see the forest for what it is. I hope that those of you who have lived through something similar and carry guilt about it long after it's over will learn that you are not the only one. So many women have made mistakes or done things they regret or become versions of themselves they aren't happy with. So many other women have survived and come out the other side stronger because of it. Every day you're choosing who you are and what you believe about yourself, and you're setting the standards for the relationships in your life. Every day is a chance to start over. Things that would have helped me. Number one, a sounding board. When I walked through this season, I didn't really have any close friends or mentors who could advise me. I think if I'd been able to speak with someone wiser, I might have become aware sooner of how unhealthy my relationship was. Be careful anytime the only voice of advisement is your own. Your judgment is easily clouded when you're in love. Number two, being prepared. When my children are old enough, I will tell them this story. I know it doesn't paint either of their parents in the best light, but I want them to learn from it. If I had been less naive and known more about self-respect, I think I would have seen our relationship for what it was. Number three, someone else's shoes. If you told the story of your relationship, both the good and the bad, would there be more good or more bad? If a friend or a stranger heard about my relationship, and if I walked them through all of the stuff that was hurting me, I can't imagine them not wanting to shake me until my teeth rattled. Imagine someone else describing your relationship to you. Would they say your relationship is healthy? If the answer is no, or if you even have to question it, I beg you to take a deeper look at the relationship in your life. Chapter 6, The Lie. No is the final answer. When asked to be a keynote speaker at a conference, I usually get to choose, to some extent, what I will talk about. Sometimes it's about business life or a more niche area of expertise, such as event planning. But the one thing most of my speeches have in common, the one thing I truly believe myself to be an expert on, is being told no. Truly, I've been told no in so many different ways and by so many different people that sometimes it seems as if life itself is saying no. I am an expert in rejection. Or more specifically, I am an expert in bouncing back from rejection and fighting my way toward my goal. I suppose if I can gift you anything in the reading of this book, it's that no is only an answer if you accept it. So allow me to use one chapter of this book to, I hope, light a fire under your butt. I want you to be so pumped up that you can hardly stand it. I want you to have one of those nights when you stay up until 1 a.m. writing long lists of big dreams and plans. You know those nights when you're so excited you can't shut off your brain and you end up having to take a Benadryl just to fall asleep? Yes. I want these words to excite you that much. I'm hoping some of my excitement rubs off on you, which, granted, would be way easier if I were giving you the speech in person. But I promise to use lots of italicized words for emphasis and to tell you about the word no and the role it's played in my life. I waited years for the opportunity to explain my relationship with rejection. A lifetime, maybe. About 6 years ago, Inc. magazine named me as one of their top 30 entrepreneurs under the age of 30. Ooh la la. It was a huge honor. I mean, clearly, because I'm still talking about it. But the really interesting thing that most people don't know is that when you get a prestigious title like that, almost immediately, you begin to make hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Just kidding. No, what happens is every college within a 100-mile radius immediately starts calling and asking if you'll come and talk to their students. Since I haven't stopped talking since the moment I figured out how, of course, I accepted every single request. Each of those sessions lasted about an hour, which consisted of 30 minutes of me chatting about my career and my company and 30 minutes of questions and answers. After a while, I could almost time to the minute when I would hear the classic question. "Hi, Rachel," they'd always begin, because apparently we call adults by their first names now like we're a bunch of hippies. "Can you tell us the secret of your success? Like, what's the one thing that truly gives you an advantage over others?" First of all, God bless our youth. God bless these wee infants who believe that a lifetime of hustling and working and sweating and stressing and building a company could be summarized with one single answer. But I tried. At first, when I was asked this question, I would give generic answers. Hard work, dedication, making yourself indispensable, blah, blah, blah. But the more I went to schools and realized it was going to be the one question I got asked every time, I decided I better figure out the truth. So I began to ask myself questions. What led to this massive platform and all of these fans? How did I get book deals and TV appearances? Why was I the one standing in front of the classroom answering questions? Why not somebody else? I think the obvious place to start is my family connections. So after graduating from Yale and then later Harvard Business School, I began working in my family's oil business. I later went on to be part owner of the Texas Rangers before becoming governor of that great state. And then, I mean, most everyone knows that my father was a former president. So when I decided to run for president myself, wait, no, that's not me. That's George W. Bush. No, as a reminder, I grew up in a place called Weed Patch. That wasn't like a cute name for locals. That's literally its moniker on any map that wants to include it. The point is, family connections haven't been the secret to my success. Seriously, though, after I moved to Los Angeles, I started to gain some pretty influential friends within the entertainment industry. Paris Hilton and I became incredibly close. Later, I went on to date Ray J. Remember him? And it really shot me into celebrity status. I used the attention from that relationship to get my own show on E! And then made millions with many kind of products. When Kanye asked me to be his wife, well, wait, shoot, nope. That's Kim Kardashian. The secret to my success isn't celebrity status. All joking aside, my success has a lot to do with waking up early, being the hardest working person in the room, asking for help, being able to fail over and over again, and working constantly to improve both myself and my brand. But plenty of people do those things and don't experience the kind of success I have. You want to know why that is? Why I believe I'm the one writing this book right now when people who've tried to do exactly the same thing I have haven't succeeded? It's simple, actually. It's not about talent, skill, money, or connections. It's because when they went after their dreams, and came up against a roadblock. When they experience rejection or when someone or something told them no, they listened. I am successful because I refuse to take no for an answer. I am successful because I have never once believed my dreams were someone else's to manage. That's the incredible part about your dreams. Nobody gets to tell you how big they can be. When it comes to your dreams, no is not an answer. The word no is not a reason to stop. Instead, think of it as a detour or a yield sign. No means merge with caution. No reminds you to slow down, to reevaluate where you are, and to judge how the new position you're in can better prepare you for your destination. In other words, if you can't get through the front door, try the side window. If the window is locked, maybe you slide down the chimney. No doesn't mean that you stop. It simply means that you change course in order to make it to your destination. I realize, though, that not everybody looks at no the way I do. In order to inspire you to run headlong after your dreams, I may have to shift your perception of no. I'm going to have to give you everything I can think of to get you there. And I'm going to start with this question. What if life isn't happening to you? What if the hard stuff, the amazing stuff, the love, the joy, the hope, the fear, the weird stuff, the funny stuff, the stuff that takes you so low you're lying on the floor crying and thinking, how did I get here? What if none of it is happening to you? What if all of it is happening for you? It's all about perception, you guys. Perception means that we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Take a burning house. To a fireman, a burning house is a job to do. Maybe even it's his life's work or mission. For an arsonist, a burning house is something exciting and good. What if it's your house? What if it's your family who's standing outside watching every earthly possession you own burning up? That burning house becomes something else entirely. You don't see things as they are. You see things through the lens of what you think and feel and believe. Perception is reality, and I'm here to tell you that your reality is colored much more by your past experiences than by what is actually happening to you. If your past tells you that nothing ever works out, that life is against you and that you'll never succeed, then how likely are you to keep fighting for something you want? Or, on the flip side, if you quit accepting no as the end of the conversation whenever you run up against opposition, you can shift your perception and fundamentally reshape your life. Every single part of your life, your gratitude, the way you manage stress, how kind you are to others, how happy you are, can be changed by a shift in your perception. I don't have an entire book to devote to this topic, so today I'm just going to focus on your dreams. Let's talk about the goals you have for your life and how you can help yourself to achieve them. In order to do that, you have to name your goals. You have to shout out your hopes and dreams like the great Bambino calling his shot. You need the courage to stand up and say, "This one, right here, this is mine." Before you continue reading, take a few moments to focus on a specific dream. Get out a piece of paper and write it down. Maybe write down 10 dreams. Maybe start with little innocuous things and keep writing until the truth comes out. Come on, girl, no one is watching. There's nobody here to judge. Cue elevator music. All right, do you have your dream? Great. Maybe for some of you, that's the first time you've admitted that dream to yourself. But I'm willing to bet that most of you have met that dream before, even if you've never had the courage to put it down on paper. Hello, old friend. Perhaps it's been around since childhood. Maybe it's something you're currently working on. Maybe you used to work on it, but you gave up. Either way, if this is still a dream you have, then chances are you've experienced some rejection where this dream is concerned. So my first mission is to change the way you see the word no, to take away your fear of it. Fear is driving your choices and affecting your decisions. So let's take the fear away. The best way I know how to do that is to talk about it. The Bible says, "Let that which is in the darkness be brought into the light." When things are allowed to sit in the darkness, when we're afraid to speak them aloud, we give them power. The darkness lets those fears fester and grow until they become stronger over time. If you never allow your fears out, then how in the world can you disseminate them? Why do you think every chapter of this book begins with a lie I used to believe? Because I want to encourage you to speak your own lies into the world. The trouble is, we rarely know they are lies until someone points them out or we get past them. Before we can name them, they just disguise themselves as things we're afraid of. Think about it. So let's take the fear away. Let's go through some of the reasons why people give up on their dreams. I want you to ask yourself if any of these examples sound like you. Some people quit because a voice of authority tells them to. Voice of authority can mean all sorts of things. Maybe your first boss said you weren't right for your dream job, and you believed it. Maybe a parent, out of love or fear or caution or their own issues, told you not to try. Maybe a spouse or a partner or best friend was afraid of what would happen to your relationship if you grew, and so they decided to keep you anchored to the ground. Maybe that voice of authority said you're not right for it. Someone said you're too fat to train for a marathon, or that you're too young to build your own business. They said you're too old to take dance lessons. They said you're too female to travel by yourself. Maybe the voice of authority is your own. Maybe the negative self-talk in your head has been playing on repeat for your entire life. Maybe an entire industry of experts is saying you're not right. I have wanted to be an author for as long as I've understood that books were created by actual people. Like most wannabe authors, I started approximately 73 manuscripts, but never actually finished a single one. Then, several years ago, I decided to stop giving up. Just once, I thought. Just once, I'd like to know what it's like to finish. So I began working on my historical fiction meets time travel book. Because, I mean, why not write that on weekends? Out of the blue, I was approached by a literary agent. Okay, just to give context, I suppose it wasn't out of the blue. I was a popular blogger and had built up a following of fans as well as a lot of publicity as a celebrity party planner by this time. The lit agent asked me if I'd ever considered writing a book. Of course I started regaling her with tales of my time-traveling historical romance, which, in case you're wondering, is basically every literary agent's worst nightmare as a pitch from an unknown, unproven author. So this woman, bless her, read the first 20 pages of that dumpster fire and politely came back a week later to inform me that it wasn't really her style. She'd actually been reaching out to see if I wanted to do a nonfiction book on party planning. Since I was expressing an interest in fiction, though, she wondered if I'd be interested in writing a romanacle. I'd never even heard of that term, but a quick Google search informed me that it's fiction about actual notable people. You just change the names to keep yourself from getting sued. A great example is The Devil Wears Prada. The agent's question was whether or not I had any juicy stories after having survived years of celebrity events. Boy, did I ever. As soon as we got off the phone, I knew the story immediately. I knew the story because it was my story. I'd moved from a small southern-minded town to Los Angeles as a teenager. Before I was old enough to drink legally, I was working parties for the biggest A-list celebrities on the planet. I was a fish out of water and always awkward, but somehow built a career within that space. I didn't have to dream up material. I had years of stories so juicy I couldn't have made them up if I tried. I wrote 10 pages and emailed them to her right away. 2 days later, she wrote back, "I can sell this all day long." A literary agent. A real-life, legit, literary agent told me that she could sell my book if I was willing to finish it. I nearly choked on my joy. I became obsessed. I barely saw my husband or my kids as I wrote like an insane person until my first draft was finished. I kept telling myself that the only reason I didn't have a book deal already was because I never actually finished a manuscript. So I believed this book was fated. I imagined in intricate detail what it would be like to hold the published copy in my hands. I did finish the book, and the literary agent sent it to every publisher in New York. The initial responses were so kind and encouraging. Editors would write long emails back explaining why it wasn't for them, but telling me how much they'd enjoyed it. My belief that we were going to sell it only increased when three other publishers asked for conference calls to discuss it. When I dialed into that first call, I thought I was going to pee my pants. When we got on the phone, the publishing team started by telling me how much they liked me, my online presence, my writing style, etc. They praised the book as funny and cute. Good things, as far as I knew. "Our concern," said the editor, "is that it's too sweet." I had no idea what that meant, but since it was my first book, I assured them that anything like that could be fixed in an edit. "We were hoping you'd be open to changes." "Of course," I assured them. "I'd be open to ritual sacrifice if it meant selling my first book." "So you'd feel comfortable adding some steam." Y'all, I had no idea what she was talking about. My brain conjured up the image of a manhole cover with steam coming out. "What exactly did you have in mind?" I hedged. "Sex. It needs sex, Rachel. No young woman in her early 20s who lives in LA is a virgin. Nobody will believe this love story. If you spice it up, this could be a bestseller." I'm trying to remember if I've ever been so uncomfortable in a professional setting in my life. For context, it's important to note that this was right when 50 Shades of Grey was breaking into the book world. Since publishing chases trends like any other industry, every editor was hyper-focused on trying to tap into that fan base. I had zero idea how to respond to them. Y'all, I'm no saint. I've read books with sex in them before. Don't tell my meemaw. But I had no earthly clue that someone would ever ask me to write it. Also, I loved that the heroine in my book was naive and innocent. And I thought that's what made her special. The more they tried to convince me to write steam into my book, the more I wondered if I was in an after-school special. Like, "Hey, Rachel, just smoke this crack and we'll be friends with you." I politely declined. "We totally understand," they told me. "But without that element, this book is too sweet for the market. Nobody will buy it as is." I was devastated. Two more calls with publishers went exactly the same way. Then, one after another, every publisher left on our submission list turned it down. It was a Friday afternoon when the very last publisher passed. I remember locking myself in the bathroom and sobbing, and you guys, these were not gentle, beautiful tears. This was like, "My dreams are over, everyone hates my book, I am a terrible writer, ugly tears." I can't tell you how long I stayed down on the bathroom tile, but I can tell you that I eventually got back up. I dried my tears and walked to the kitchen to pour a glass of wine. Then I sat down at my crappy laptop where I'd written my terrible, prudish manuscript that nobody wanted and Googled, "How do you self-publish a book?" In February of 2014, I self-published Party Girl, about a naive, sweet, and yes, virginal party planner in her early 20s living in LA. That first weekend, I think it sold 50 copies, and likely 45 of those were bought by Dave. Every week, though, I'd sell a few here and a handful there. The sales kept growing, and people were passing it around to their friends. As it turns out, the sweetness of the main character was the exact thing that people liked about the book. 6 months later, a publisher called and asked if they could buy it from me and offer me a deal for two more books to turn it into a series. To date, that single book, the one I was told no one would buy, has sold over 100,000 copies. It also launched my career as an author. Here's the most important piece of that whole story. Are you paying attention? If I had listened to the experts, that book would still be sitting on my computer today. Nobody. Not a voice of authority, not your mama, not the foremost expert in your arena, gets to tell you how big your dreams can be. They can talk all they want, but you get to decide if you're willing to listen. Another reason people give up on their dreams? It's difficult or it's taking too long. Goals and dreams are hard. I get it. Actually accomplishing them is so much harder than you think it will be. Maybe you're making progress, but it's only an inch at a time. Meanwhile, your friend Tammy has been promoted twice, your sister is married with two kids, and you feel as though you're still way back there at the start when everyone is passing you by. Some days you feel so discouraged you want to cry. Go ahead and cry. Rend your garments and wail to the heavens like some biblical mourner. Get it all out. Then dry your eyes and wash your face and keep on going. You think this is hard? That's because it is. So what? Nobody said it would be easy. You're tired? How many times in your life have you been tired but you found a way to keep going? How many of you reading this right now have given up on a dream because it was exhausting to keep chasing it? In the same vein, how many of you have ever gone through labor? Even if you haven't before, I know you can understand the gist. No matter how you bring a baby into the world, even through adoption, it's emotionally and physically exhausting, but somehow you find a way through. You dig down deep for strength you didn't know you had because the process is literally life or death. Don't tell me you don't have it in you to want something more for your life. Don't tell me you have to give up because it's difficult. This is life or death too. This is the difference between living a life you always dreamed of or sitting alongside the death of the person you were meant to become. That's what it feels like to me when I've given up on a dream, even for a little while, as if I'm at a wake, as if I'm sitting in a room and looking at the evidence of what could have been. I'm sure many of you know what that's like, and you either want to change it or keep yourself from getting there in the first place. You have to do something about it. You have to reach down inside yourself and remember the reason you started this. You better find the will to keep going, because if you don't, I promise you someone else will. If that happens, girl, you will watch someone else achieve your dreams and enjoy the spoils of their hard-fought battle. And if that happens, you will understand one of the greatest lessons in this life, that the only thing worse than giving up is wishing that you hadn't. You think your dream is taking too long? It took Julia Child 10 years to write Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Her work changed cooking for people all over the world and launched her career. James Cameron worked on Avatar for 15 years, and it is the most successful film in the history of time. On January 3, 1870, ground was broken for the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge. That project took 10 years, and during that time, the lives of so many men on the building crew were lost. But you guys, the Brooklyn Bridge still stands as a symbol of New York, and 135 years later, it brings 43 million cars to and from Manhattan every single year. Don't you get it? Nothing that lasts is accomplished quickly. Nobody's entire legacy is based on a single moment, but rather the collection of one's experiences. If you're lucky, your legacy will be a lifetime in the making. Between my event company and the media business I run now, it's taken me 13 years of work to get to this place, and not one of those years was wasted. I needed 13 years to gain the knowledge to write to you about this topic. I needed 13 years of speaking to college students, MOPS groups, and panel discussions to build my skill enough to give the keynote speech that served as the inspiration for this chapter. I needed to fail at public speaking and make mistakes over and over again to learn how to do that. I needed to write crappy manuscripts that I never finished and then one that nobody wanted to buy. I needed to fight my way into the publishing industry and spend years making my presence known before I was in a place where someone would give me the opportunity for a book like this. I needed to endure personal hardships and discouragement and one rejection on top of another, all so that I could stand right here and say to you, your dream is worth fighting for. And while you're not in control of what life throws at you, you are in control of the fight. The last reason people give up on their dreams? Something traumatic gets in your way. Disaster is the ultimate excuse. Divorce or illness or something far worse happens to you, and sometimes the goals slip quietly into the background and get left there. We leave them because this trauma is so heavy, we just can't carry one more thing. Sometimes trauma happens, and if we're being honest, part of us rejoices, thinking, well, now nobody can expect anything else from me because it's a miracle enough that I'm upright. Let me take a moment to tell those of you who are dealing with and fighting through something painful, it is a miracle that you're sitting here. You are nobly doing your best to battle your way through it. You are a warrior because of the trials you are going through. But don't you dare squander the strength you have earned just because the acquisition of it was painful. Those are the most important stories to share. You can use that strength to pave a path for others to follow along behind. I've shared many of my own painful stories in the chapters of this book, and none of them have been easy to talk about. But I do it because I hope that by sharing them, I'm able to help some of you who've walked through similar things. I've also talked about my own goals and dreams and the way I've pushed myself to achieve them. Every single one of those dreams has served a purpose in my life. Sometimes it was a small change, and sometimes it was life-changing. But in every circumstance, I grew for having walked through it. Friends, it's not about the goal or the dream you have. It's about who you become on your way to that goal. When a voice of authority says it's taking too long, you're too fat, old, tired, or female for it, or your trauma is too big, do you know what they are giving you? Permission to quit. You're already scared. You're already second-guessing yourself. And when someone or something comes along and speaks into that exact thing you were already questioning, you think, yep, that's what I thought. I give up. Look again at those dreams you wrote down on your paper at the start of this chapter. Now listen to me. You do not have permission to quit. I revoke that permission. I take away the power those people or circumstances put over your life, and I give it back to you. You think it's not that easy? Of course it is. This is all about perception, right? Your perception of what's holding you back is currently big and bad and terrifying, but those obstacles are only real if you believe them. It's all in your hands now. Everything that happens from here on out is entirely up to you. This is the hard part because I will tell you right now, nobody will ever care about your dream as much as you do. Ever. Do you hear me, sister? Whether you want to lose weight or write a book or be on TV or travel the world on a speaking tour, you are the steward of your own dreams. Maybe you want to own your own home, get your degree, or save your marriage. Maybe it's a shop on Etsy, opening a small business, or getting the lead in the local production of Oklahoma this fall. Whatever it is, big or small, grandiose or simple, nobody can care about it the way you do. Even if you have a supportive family, even if you have the greatest friends alive, Even if your spouse is the most uplifting, encouraging human and your number one fan, even then, girl, they do not want it as much as you do. It doesn't keep them up at night. It doesn't light their soul on fire. It's your dream. Your own special wish that your heart made long before you were even conscious of it. You want to see it come to fruition? Well, then, you have to understand that nobody can take it away from you, and ultimately, nobody is going to help you achieve it. Not really. You have to decide to pursue your wildest dreams, no matter what they are, no matter how simple or extravagant, no matter if they seem ridiculous to others or maybe even too easy. It doesn't matter. They're your dreams, and you are allowed to chase them. Not because you are more special or talented or well-connected, but because you are worthy of wanting something more. Because you are worthy of not letting your past dictate your future. Start today. Start right now, this very second, and promise yourself, heck, promise me, that you'll reach for the big stuff. Do you want the big stuff for your life? You won't get there by saying yes. Yes is the easy part. You'll get there by not giving up when you hear the word no. Things that helped me. Number one, audacity. It's pretty audacious to ignore what other people, even experts, are telling you is right. I think we could all use a little more audacity around these parts. I don't mean that you need to become militant or disrespectful. I just mean you should keep your eyes on your goal regardless of what gets in your way. Number two, alternate paths. I worry when I give this advice that some random person who listens to the idea of not giving up on her dreams will hear, "Go harass people until they give you what you want." That's not going to get anybody anywhere, and we all know it. Use the no you hear as an indication that you should try an alternative route. Number three, keeping my goals in plain sight. It's easy to focus on your goals when you're fired up or excited about a new project. But focusing becomes harder when life interferes with your direct access to keep working on it. So pin up your dream somewhere you can see it. I'm a big fan of displaying visuals inside my closet door to remind me every single day of what my aim is. Currently taped to my door, the cover of Forbes featuring self-made female CEOs, a vacation house in Hawaii, and a picture of Beyonce. Obvi.